Good evening. In the news tonight, a deadly train crash in Hoboken, New Jersey.
It could be anything. We have no idea.
The 9/11 families get to sue Saudi Arabia.
Terry didn't just lose a husband. She lost a father to a young son, 7, a daughter of 4, and a newborn baby boy.
A small Harlem child is dead of neglect and abuse. The family of Ramarley Graham wants answers. High pollution levels in the South Bronx, North Brooklyn, and Sunset Park.
We're talking about fighting and making sure that you don't bring another transfer station to deliver more trash.
And supporters stand with Brooklyn Councilmember Jemani Williams in his New York City Council protest during the Pledge of Allegiance.
We are looking for equity.
With these and other stories in New York, I'm Linda Perry, and this is some of the news for Thursday, September 29th, 2016. A train crashed in Hoboken, New Jersey during rush hour this morning. 108 people were injured. There's at least one fatality. The New Jersey Transit train was not equipped with a technology designed to slow speeding trains. U.S. railroads are under government orders to install the system. It's called Positive Train Control, but work has gone more slowly than expected. The deadline has been repeatedly extended. Now it's at December 31st, 2018. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo.
The positive train control system no doubt can be a benefit depending on the circumstances. And what we're saying here is we don't know what the circumstances were that caused the train to continue at that rate of speed. It could be any number of things. It could be personal to the conductor. It could be an equipment failure. It could be anything. We have no idea.
Cuomo says we won't know what happened today, that the train came in at a high rate of speed, that if we come up with reforms, that's what we'll do. Resources are being pooled between New York, New Jersey, and the Port Authority to ease the commute tomorrow. The speeding train crashed through a barrier at the busy Hoboken station. It lurched across the waiting area on Thursday morning. People pulled concrete off bleeding victims. Passengers kicked out windows. They crawled out amid crying and screaming after the train ran off the end of its track. Apparently, the train knocked out pillars as it ground to a halt in a covered waiting area. A section of the roof collapsed onto the first car. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie says there's no indication so far that the crash was anything but a tragic accident. In other news, there's the young boy, Zamir Perkins. He was only 6 years old. He was never enrolled in school. He was battered and abused, and he died on Monday. His mom and her boyfriend faced charges. The boy lived with them on 135th Street in Harlem. The Administration for Children's Services didn't prevent his death. Mayor de Blasio says he's very concerned about the case, that there were warning signs looked at by a variety of agencies. But the case is too reminiscent of another child, Nix Mary Brown, who died of abuse not prevented by the city. Child Welfare Agency. She was only 7 years old. She lived in Bed-Stuy. She was abused and murdered, Mayor de Blasio.
And that's what's troubling to me. I was very actively involved after the Nix Mary Brown case because in that instance, I mean, I remember all these cases well and what we learned from each one. In that case, different agencies had an opportunity to do something, and that included NYPD, DOE, and ACS in the case of Nix Mary Brown. I want to know what happened here. I do believe there's been some very big changes between in the relationship between the NYPD and ACS, for example, which used to be a very contentious relationship before Nix Mary Brown. I think that's a very different and better relationship. But I still need to understand how on earth this could have happened. I don't understand how it could have.
Zamir's mother, Geraldine Perkins, and her boyfriend, Rashim Smith, were arrested. Prosecutors say Smith repeatedly beat the child that they lived in squalor with walls covered in mold. They said an autopsy showed Zamir was malnourished and had several fractured ribs in various stages of healing, many scars and bruises, including marks on his neck and back. The medical examiner's office is conducting further studies. In other news, for the first time in 8 years, on Wednesday, Congress voted overwhelmingly to override a veto by President Barack Obama. It passed the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, or JASTA. The bill allows families of those killed in the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks to sue Saudi Arabia for any role in the plot. Just before the vote, New York Senator Chuck Schumer addressed the Senate for the record.
We cannot forget what this legislation means to the families of victims. It has been 15 years since Miss Terry Estrada lost her husband, Tom, who worked in the North Tower. Terry didn't just lose a husband. She lost a father to a young son, Seven, a daughter of four, and a newborn baby boy. She lost a loving father and her best friend. Terry and her three children have championed this bill for over a decade. I thank them and all the other families, especially Monica Gabriel, Mindy Kleinberg, Lori Van Auken, Kristen Brittweiser, Patty Casaza, for their tireless advocacy and patience. Of course, no compensation could ever repair the broken hearts of a family that lost a loved one to such mindless hate. But as Jane Bartels, a mother from Staten Island who lost her husband Carlton on that sunny morning 15 years ago, put it recently, we just want our day in court.
For the record, New York Senator Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor is speaking out for the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, or JASTA, just before overturning President Barack Obama's veto. Last week, the Senate backed a $1.15 billion arms sale to Saudi Arabia. Chuck Schumer voted for the measure. Regarding JASTA, already today, some lawmakers, including Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair Tennessee Senator Bob Corker, are plotting to weaken the law. In other New York City news, the family of Romarley Graham and supporters want NYPD records released on the police killing of the 18-year-old in his Bronx home by NYPD officer Richard Haste. They say these officers threatened, assaulted, and mistreated Romarley's family after his death, that the NYPD unlawfully leaked information about Romarley's sealed criminal history and disseminated false information about the incident. None of the multiple officers engaged in the misconduct related to the killing have been held accountable. Identities of some of them have been concealed. The family is saying the de Blasio administration hasn't provided Graham's family with information that would indicate that the NYPD will hold all of the officers accountable. And regarding Richard Haste, they say the date hasn't been set for his departmental trial, and they haven't gotten any information on what charges he's facing. You can find out more on Twitter by going to Romarley's Call. In other news, a demonstration and press conference outside City Hall is being planned for tomorrow. This as the City Council holds a hearing on helping small businesses who are driven from their locations by massive rent increases. The groups protesting charge that the council is ignoring the most effective proposal of all to fix the problem. Richard Barr has more.
It was back in 1984 that then City Councilwoman Ruth Messinger proposed a Small Business Survival Act, which would have protected mom-and-pop stores from massive rent increases and short-term lease renewals. The bill, and subsequent versions of it, though often attracting the support of a majority of the council, has never been brought to the floor for a vote. Council speakers from Peter Vallone through Christine Quinn and currently Melissa Mark Viverito have always blocked a floor vote. The current version is called the Small Business Jobs Survival Act, and it purportedly has the backing of a 27-vote majority. But the Council's Small Business Committee is holding a hearing tomorrow on zoning and incentives for small businesses instead. Groups advocating commercial rent regulation to prevent the widespread loss of mom-and-pop stores don't buy the talk among political leaders, which cite legal barriers to enacting commercial rent control. They say these are talking points of landlord lobby groups that are being parroted by council leadership. Tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., before the committee hearing, there will be a demonstration and press conference in support of the Small Business Jobs and Security Act in front of City Hall. The organizers include Take Back NYC, New Yorkers for a Human Scale City, and the Artist Studio Affordability Project. Richard Barr, WBAI News, New York.
And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. Andy King, New York City Council member from the Bronx, has been working to curtail pollution from trucks and transfer stations in the Bronx.
When we had all the transfer and the garbage stations down in the Hunts Point area, and we were fighting to make sure that there weren't more garbage being put because of the asthma rates, because of the poor trash, because of the trucks who are coming through all the diesel fuel or smoke that's going up in the air that was causing Bronxites to get sick. So yeah, we have an issue that we need to protect our Bronxites, because not only will it settle into the Bronx, the southern part of the Bronx, it will move through the rivers, you know, as trash and liquids fall into our waterways, and it'll travel all throughout the borough of the Bronx, let alone into Manhattan and upstate. So yeah, there's an issue that we need to be very mindful of, and that means what? That means telling everyone to be careful how you discard your trash and recycle wherever you can, and be careful what you put into the environment, from aerosol sprays and cans, you know. And if we're talking about fighting and making sure that you don't bring another transfer station to deliver more trash, then you know you got to respect it, because the city of New York has identified pockets of where they're going to put stuff, whether it is not environmentally feasible for them, but because geography, it makes good geography for them. But for the people who have to live in those environments, it's not fair. So everyone needs to, if everyone's making trash, everyone should be regarded to handle their fair share.
And a new study is out by environmental justice activists. They went out and they measured how much air pollution was being generated by private garbage trucks into commercial waste zones. The Environmental Justice Alliance found that air pollution readings in the South Bronx, in North Brooklyn, and in Sunset Park are 7 times higher than the city's own Department of Environmental Conservation readings. And they found that the readings were equally high inside the truck cabins for workers. WBAI's Rebecca Miles spoke with Priya Mulgunkor, project coordinator for the New York City Environmental Justice Alliance.
What it was that started you looking at these commercial trucks and what they were contributing to air pollution in the areas of the South Bronx, North Brooklyn, and Sunset Park?
We've actually, as part of our coalition with Transform Don't Trash, we've been looking at the issue of commercial waste from various standpoints. So we've already looked at it from the standpoint of, you know, small businesses whom these carters service. We've looked at it from the perspective of workers in this industry, this largely unregulated, very dangerous industry that has a bad reputation for violating safety standards. So really we wanted to take a look now at environmental health and environmental justice concerns around this industry, and really how is the inefficiency of this industry playing out in our backyards. So one main concern is that there are almost 200, 250 different carting companies servicing a finite number of businesses. So on any given block, you could have 10 businesses being serviced by 10 different carters, and that's 10 trucks rolling by through the night picking up garbage. And so obviously that makes no sense. Why would you need multiple trucks picking up on the same geographic route? And what this results in is just hundreds and hundreds of vehicle miles traveled by largely diesel trucks. The commercial carters aren't really incentivized to upgrade their trucks to meet EPA standards or city standards. So you have, you know, only about 10% of that huge fleet complying with 2007 emission standards by the EPA. And they're just crisscrossing and overlapping along illogical routes, making up to 600 stops every night. And then at the end of the night, you know, about 3/4 of all of the city's waste is processed in just a handful of majority low-income and communities of color in the South Bronx, North Brooklyn, and Southeast Queens. So we were really just putting two and two together. We have all these trucks. We know that diesel and even trucks that, you know, that have diesel with filters on them, it still ends up emitting particulate matter 2.5, which has been linked to respiratory illness, asthma, cancer. It's a really toxic pollutant. And in our work trying to just transform the way commercial waste operates, we wanted to really flag the public health concerns.
Yes. And I know that your report comes with recommendations. What are some of those?
We want the city to judge the quality of the proposals from carters based on also which transfer facilities they select to use? Are they, because if you have a waste district in, you know, the lower, in the financial district of Manhattan, it's not efficient if they pick up everything and then end up driving and dumping in the South Bronx.
WBAI's Rebecca Miles with Priya Magankor of the Environmental Justice Alliance. In other environmental news this week, Governor Andrew Cuomo announced a significant milestone in the advancement of solar power. Andrea Sears reports.
The completion of the 35,000th residential solar installation on Long Island this week marked a 320% increase in solar power over the past 4 years. Adrian Esposito, director of the Citizens Campaign for the Environment, says the numbers show that Long Islanders get it.
We understand climate change is real. We're at the front line here on Long Island for the damage and the devastation caused by climate change. Solar is one of the answers in our renewable energy portfolio.
Long Island is New York State's largest market for residential solar power. According to Esposito, the rapid growth of solar is due in part to economics. She says the cost of electricity on Long Island is very high, and the payoff for residential rooftop solar is now from 5 to 7 years.
So that's a very short timeline, given the fact that after that, your electricity is basically almost zero.
The state has launched a $1 billion NY Sun initiative, offering incentives such as low-interest financing to bring solar power to 150,000 New York homes and businesses by 2020. Long Island also is seeing huge potential growth in wind power. Later this year, the nation's first offshore wind farm will go into operation near Block Island, and Esposito says a much larger project has been proposed for off Montauk.
And that would be a 90 megawatt or 15 turbine wind farm. And if that gets approved, that could be the second one in the United States of America.
Both wind and solar are key to achieving New York State's goal of getting 50% of its electric power from renewable resources by 2030. For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
At City Hall this week, support for New York City Councilmember Jamani Williams and his right to stay seated during the Pledge of Allegiance at City Council stated meetings. For this action, the Brooklyn Councilmember has been receiving hate mail, emails, and racist tweets.
One, I received overwhelmingly positive support on social media, on Twitter, on Instagram, on emails, also from my colleagues. Of course, the human mind forgets about those and sometimes focuses on the negativity. So I did receive a lot of negative emails, a lot of tweets. The worst one was probably said that I was a waste of life. They were all kind of like that. That you kind of get used to. The mail was kind of jarring. I received mail in the past, nothing to this effect. The Daily News did do a story. One of them was pretty explicit. One of them had me circle, said, "Drop dead, you F." Talked about plantation monkeys. It was about three or four. I think one of them said that the plantation owner should have aborted my great-great-grandmother. It was pretty creative, actually. But I don't think they even understood the irony of what they were doing in response to what I was doing. So I am just sorry that they're carrying so much hate in their heart. And my hope is that they can begin to see just in fact what they're doing and how they're proving my point.
Williams says police and gun violence have been ignored for far too long. He is going to remain seated during the Pledge of Allegiance at City Council meetings until a task force dealing with jobs for youth comes out with a report, and that Mayor de Blasio, who has agreed to fund whatever is in the report, puts it in the budget. And Jamani Williams is pushing back on the notion that sitting during the pledge is anti-American.
There is nothing anti-American about trying to force America to stand up to its own ideals. In addition, many people fought for my right to do this type of protest.
I want you to understand why we can assemble here today is because of my action.
Vietnam vet Herbert Sweat served in Vietnam from 1966 through 1970. At City Hall, he says he was given the right to fight overseas, but it seems he doesn't have the right to fight at home.
And that right to fight at home is to speech, to have a freedom of speech, to have a freedom of assembly, to have the freedom to do as one pursue to do for their harmony and happiness here in America.
Errol Van Newton is another Vietnam vet. He speaks out for the right to protest. He received the Purple Heart.
In my services to the United States, I fought for the rights to do what you choose to do as long as it is legal. And each time I hear someone criticizing the other person for expressing their right or dissension about some governmental act or some act that they consider to be unconstitutional or unfair, I look at the bullet wound that I have on my left thigh. Mm. And this reminds me that I paid a price for this, and I will never, ever let anyone take away that right from anyone. I'm here.
Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams is a former New York State senator and former member of the NYPD. He says he will always stand for the American flag.
I will always salute the flag. I will always put my hand across my heart in support of the American flag. I, like Jemani, love this country. And when you love something as dear as we do, we want it to be the best. And being the best means understanding and respecting when someone takes a knee or someone sits down or someone decides not to say the pledge. The methods that we use is solely up to the individual to express that.
And Adams makes the difference clear between the protest of a Brooklyn council member and acts of violence throughout the nation.
Jemani did not stand on the rooftop in Dallas, Texas and shoot innocent people. Jemani did not plant a bomb in Chelsea and blow up innocent people. Jemani did not walk into a black church and shoot innocent people. Jemani did not drive planes into the trade center and shoot innocent people. Jemani protested in the manner that's outlined in our Constitution that the vets fought for, that police protect for, and that legislators make laws for. Jemani did it the right way. He did it that all of our children can look and say, even when you move up to the highest level of government, you still can maintain your desire to make the country what it ought to maintain. I walked on the Senate floor as a state senate when Trayvon Martin was killed, and I put a hoodie on to make a statement that young men of color, no matter where they are, if in the senatorial chamber, if it's walking in the chamber of their buildings, should not be the victims of violence. And so, when you have those who will salute the flag, stand next to those who would take a knee with the flag, it's sending the right message. It's not about desecrating the flag. It's about stopping the violence that America has ignored for far too long.
Antonio Reynoso, Brooklyn council member, says the conversation isn't about whether we should stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, but whether we are doing enough to protect our black and brown people in our communities. New York State Assembly member Diana Richardson agrees. She says the protest is about the deeper problem of what's going on in America.
We are looking for justice. We are looking for equity. We are looking for it not just for some, but for all. So if you find that us taking this stance is unpatriotic, you really need to look in the mirror and ask yourself, where is your patriotism, where you could watch that so many people are being murdered across the United States of America, yet you do nothing but text and send mail.
Assemblymember Richardson says to Williams, we've got your back and support everything you do. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Thursday, September 29th, 2016. The news was produced with Rebecca Miles, Richard Barr, Andrea Sears, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.